So thanks very much to the organizers for the invitation. And thanks to those of you who did not leave for my talk, because it's been a long day. Fortunately, I think they may give us some wine after this, so I'll try to finish on time. I also am not going to talk about high field physics. I'm actually going to talk about graphene. And I actually have two stories to tell, and I don't have time to tell both of them well. So what I'm going to do is tell them both poorly. And then if you want to ask more, I'd be happy to talk to you later. So the thing I want to talk about is the issue of strong correlations in graphene, and in particular the issue of the value of this of a quantity called the fine structure constant, which is often discussed now in the field, let's say in the last year or so. But there is another thing I'd like to talk about, which is a, let's say, somewhat unorthodox approach to studying attosecond phenomena. And this is something I discovered by accident about 6 years ago when I was a postdoc at Cornell. And I've been doing ever since, though sort of in secret because, well, that's a long story. At any rate, just so I don't blow the punchline, let me just start by saying that if you talk to a good microscopist, they will tell you that there are two ways to do microscopy. One is in focused beam mode, where you scan around and you look at images with a focused beam. The other mode is in parallel beam mode, where you measure diffraction spots and then try to invert the diffraction pattern to make images that way. Okay, and which of these is a better way to do it actually depends on the specific system and the details of the experiment and so on. And the advantage to doing it in diffraction mode is that in principle the spatial resolution can be very good, because you can just go out to very large Q and get very good spatial resolution. The disadvantage is you have to solve the phase problem. So if you have to set in constraints and have good data and theories and so on. So which works better depends. So what I'm going to do is try to argue that there is an analogous phase problem that exists along the time axis, not along the space axis, that allows you, under the right circumstances, to get ultra-fast dynamics. And when this works, which is not all the time, the time resolutions you can get are extremely high. So I'll show you movies of electrons with time resolutions of 10 attoseconds in just a few minutes. And it's interesting, when I give this talk at graphene conferences, no one's the slightest bit interested in the movies. They just want to know what this number is. So it's a refreshing thing to be at this meeting where people actually care about technique. Oh yeah, so I want to thank my student, James Reed, who did the experiments, and a young theorist, Bruno Uchoa, who I collaborated with extensively on developing the algorithms. So what is graphene, just for this group? Graphene is a single layer of graphite. This stuff has been around as long as the Earth, I assume, and you make it every time you write with a pencil. But it's now all the craze because people in Manchester figured out how to see it. So they were able to make graphene by mechanical exfoliation and actually managed to find a piece under a microscope. So that sort of started a revolution in the field. The beautiful thing about it is it's very thin, it's very strong, and it's very cheap. And it has a very high, it turns out, electron mobility. And the reason for that comes down to probably what is the driver of the interest behind the field, which is its very unusual electronic structure. So graphene is sort of like a semiconductor. It has a valence band and a conduction band, and they're gapped at all parts in momentum space except for two spots. And they are, so the valence band and the conduction bands meet at one point. And this is just a quirky outcome of the honeycomb structure of the lattice. And these two points are called the K and K prime point. They are symmetry independent. And there, if you look and zoom in closely, you can see that the valence and conduction bands meet just in one spot. And so the beauty of this is it means the density of states of the system is zero, or anyway, it's infinitesimal, meaning it's always determined by external things like how many impurities you have around, or the strain and defects and so on. So one of the things that one of the consequences of graphene is gate tunable. So you can adjust its conductance with a gate voltage, which means you can make transistors out of it. So Intel is investing large amount of money in graphene research because they think it may obviate silicon because it's extremely cheap. The other reason is that it turns out, the massless Dirac equation in two dimensions, which is really interesting to people who like relativistic quantum mechanics. So right around there, the dispersions of the bands are linear. They follow this equation, and that allows all kinds of analogies with high energy physics to be studied in a condensed matter setting. And I don't want to get too much into the details, but the basic thing is, in addition to this thing being satisfied, these two different indices, these two different, they call them valleys, are actually symmetry independent, and that means that the fermions, in addition to being Dirac-like, have a flavor index, sort of like an isospin symmetry between these two sublattices, and it turns out to be of chiral character, because if you do time reversal operation, it takes one sublattice and transfers it to the other one. So there are all kinds of really interesting things, and it's just sort of driven a revolution in the field. And it's a really neat system. And one of the latest crazes is the issue of strong correlations. Okay, so in condensed matter physics, strong correlations is a big deal. These are the things that give you things like high temperature superconductivity and the cuprates, and there are claims that these also are present in graphene. And the argument that they do is the following. So the strength of interactions in an electron gas is governed by this ratio, the ratio of the potential energy divided by the kinetic energy of the carriers. So in 2D electron gases, this is the quantity that people always plot. In three dimensions, it has units of length, and it's called RS, and it scales like the inverse 1/3 power of the D. So in electron gases, if they're very dilute, this quantity is large, and then you get strong correlation effects. So the question is, what is this in graphene? In graphene, it turns out that if you just take this ratio, it's a dimensionless constant. I'm sorry, did I say this had units of length? I did not. It is dimensionless. Sorry, I think I've had a bit of a long day myself. Anyway, it has a meaning of length, characterizing a dimensionless distance between the electrons. Sorry about that. Anyway, in graphene, it's also dimensionless, and it has the following form. It's simply E squared over H bar VF. And this is a quirk. So the key thing is, this does not depend on the electron density. It only depends on the Fermi velocity, the slope of the bands through that point. And this is sort of a quirky outcome of the fact that the bands disperse linearly and that they do this in two dimensions. This thing ends up being independent of density. And if you look at it closely, it looks a lot like the fine structure constant in quantum electrodynamics. So, you know, the strength of interactions in QED in three dimensions is given by alpha, which I'll put alpha QED on it just to distinguish, is E squared over H bar C, and that's 1 over 137. So this is the reason that QED works, right? Because this quantity is the small expansion parameter for electromagnetic interactions in three dimensions, band in it, which means perturbation theory works and Feynman diagrams work. And that's why we have quantum electrodynamics. So in graphene, if you just plug in the numbers, let's for the moment take this epsilon, which is the substrate dielectric screening, to be 1. Alpha is 2.2. Okay? So this quantity is bigger than 1. And what that means is that in graphene, there is no small expansion parameter for electromagnetic interactions. And that means that graphene is innately strongly correlated and it should exhibit all kinds of exotic behavior. Okay, that's the claim. And there are many claims of what this exotic behavior ought to be. Some people say it should be an excitonic insulator. There's a really interesting paper claims that graphene will actually be a perfect fluid that will exhibit electronic turbulence. And there's a whole story about that I don't have time to get into. And there are a lot of predictions. Nonetheless, if you do an experiment, you measure graphene, it's a boring old semi-metal. And some of these things are actually very hard to observe, but there are more mundane predictions, in particular anomalies in the velocity, the Fermi velocity, as a function of momentum, which you can measure easily with ARPES or with scanning electron transistor experiments or tunneling, and those things have also not been seen. So it seems that there is a conflict between the value of this and the phenomenology. And you know, the field is progressing sort of harmoniously. There are the experimentalists on one side who talk about graphene as if it's weakly interacting, and the theorists talk about it as if it's strongly interacting. And the only reason everyone is harmoniously happy is that they don't actually know what the value of this thing is. So what we decided to do, and characteristically bad judgment, is to try to measure it, which means it's actually a really bad idea, because never measure something where no matter what you do, someone's going to be angry at you when you're done. I don't have the wisdom to know things like that in advance. So, okay, so how do you measure a thing like the fine structure constant? So the fine structure constant in three dimensions has the following meaning. So let's say you have a charge and you put it in the vacuum, and another one, you ask, what's the interaction between those? The answer is, it doesn't. The relevant interaction is not the bare one. It's actually the dressed interaction. So the thing that you measure in your lab, E squared over R, is actually the dressed Coulomb interaction, dressed by all the fluctuations in polarization of the vacuum, okay? So to measure what the fine structure constant is in graphene, basically what you have to do is take a charge, put it in a graphene sheet, see how it's dressed by all the excitations of the vacuum, and then use that to compute, it turns out, the renormalized charge, okay, of the electron, which you then would put into this formula. Instead of E squared, you'd put an E star squared, which would give you the value of the renormalized alpha. So the quantity that will let you do that is this quantity here. It's called the density Green's function, or you might call it the density propagator. And this thing physically has the meaning that if I create a quantum in the density at x1 at time t1, the amplitude that it'll propagate to x2 at some other time t2. So in high energy physics, or in condensed matter physics, knowledge of this generally is considered complete knowledge of the dynamics of the system. AMO people would take issue with that, but that's just a cultural thing, okay? So the nice thing about this is it actually gives you, in general, a relationship between bound and free charge. So it is a description of the dielectric properties of the medium. So in other words, if I have some generic external charge, like a charge that I put in my medium, then I just take chi, multiply by the Coulomb interaction, 1 over q squared in three dimensions, and that gives me whatever charges are induced, okay? And this will give you the dressed charge and all the fine structure constant and so on. So just as a bit of foreshadowing, so we're going to measure this thing soon, and we're going to consider two cases. One where the N external is just E, so that would correspond to a charge that appears and disappears instantaneously at the origin, and that will turn out to show us what the collective charge dynamics look like. And the other case is where that charge is actually static, where you just put it there and leave it there, and you get to see how the vacuum fluctuations address it. Okay, so we're going to study these two cases. So let me just say now that chi here is written as a function of only one momentum variable, k, and that contains an implicit assumption that the system has translational symmetry, that is, a graphene sheet is homogeneous. If the system is inhomogeneous, this thing is actually a function of two momenta. I'm just pointing that out now because I'm going to come back to it in a few minutes. So the technique we use is inelastic X-ray scattering, okay? And I want to make a little general point about scattering here, so I guess I'll skip most of the details, but the bottom line is that to do scattering, you have to use this diagram. So the A function, the vector potential, is actually an operator. The interaction that we use is actually this one, so it's A squared times N. So this is the thing that gives you Thompson scattering. This, under the right experimental conditions, you can isolate that and use it. And the nice thing about that is if you plug it into Fermi's golden rule and compute what the scattering cross-section is for a photon, it looks like this. So it's just looks like the Thompson cross-section, but it has this thing on the side, and that thing is called the dynamic structure factor. And it's basically a sum on all the transition charge densities of all the excited states weighted by the Boltzmann factor, which is the temperature, given by the temperature of the system, with a delta function that describes the energy conservation, okay? So doing this technique, you can measure S of Q and omega. So why would you want to do that? The reason you would want to do that is S of Q and omega can give you the dynamics, but it doesn't do it straight away, okay? So what is S of Q and omega? It is the Fourier transform of a thing that is called G, and G is the Van Hove space-time correlation function for the density, okay? So if you just take the density and at x and t and that at x plus x prime, t plus t prime, and average, then you get G. It's just an autocorrelation function of n. You take that in Fourier transform, and that's what you measure in the experiment, okay? So interestingly, when we say that we do diffraction, which we've heard that word a lot this week, what you're actually measuring is S without any energy analysis, just putting a detector at some remote location. When you do that, you actually measure the frequency integral of this thing, and that turns out to be an equal time correlation function and not just pure diffraction, okay? Okay, but so the point here is that whenever we say we describe our scattering in terms of form factors and things like that, what you're doing is assuming that the dynamical processes in here are negligible. Okay, and they're not always, but you're assuming that they are. But in general, they're there, and you can measure them with this thing, and even better yet, with that. So that's the good thing about S. The bad thing about S, so the good thing about S is it tells you information about the excitations, about the dynamics, but it doesn't tell you a lot, okay? So it just gives you a correlation function, an autocorrelation function. It doesn't give you microscopic dynamical information. It just tells you what are the time scales and the length scales over which fluctuations are occurring in my system, okay? Not just classical fluctuations, but also quantum fluctuation. It does not give you an explicit measure of dynamics. So viewing this thing would be sort of like taking your diffraction pattern and just Fourier transforming it straight away. What you get then is an autocorrelator for the density, which doesn't tell you what the protein structure is. It just tells you maybe how big it is roughly, but not microscopically. Fortunately, S is actually related to this chi, the propagator, the thing that really tells you the dynamics. And the relationship is a thing called the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And this in particular is the quantum mechanical version of that, where the thing out front is not just the temperature, but the Bose factor. And S, it turns out, is related to the dissipative properties of chi, the imaginary part. Okay? So S does not tell me everything about the dynamics, but it will give me information about this chi function, which does. So you might think, well, why don't I just, how can I reconstruct this chi from that? And I guess I've already made the point that you can't just Fourier transform it. If you do that, you just get some autocorrelation function. And so in other words, on the time axis, like in the space axis, there is a phase problem in scattering, okay? And it's almost exactly the same as the phase problem in the momentum spatial direction. And what you have to do is solve this, and if you can solve it, you can get all the dynamics out microscopically. Okay, so how can you, so the point is, so this is sort of the key thing. If you can parameterize the imaginary part of this thing over sufficiently broad range of energy and momentum, you can reconstruct its real part from Kramer's chromic. And the reason you can do that is because in the end, you know that this chi function, whatever it is causal, right? So it's got this theta function sitting on it, which means whatever I do to the system now is only going to influence its properties in the future, not its properties in the past. And that is a constraint, right? Whenever you do phase retrieval, you always have to assume some constraint, like the electron density is real or something like that. The analogous constraint that you can use for energy loss scattering is this one, causality. Okay, it just says all the poles are in the lower half of the complex plane, where this thing is satisfied. So it seems trivial, but it's not. There's actually a fairly deep thing, because basically chi is, the way I wrote it down, is actually a retarded Green's function. So this is the retarded density-density correlator, but that is strictly a convention, right? So for a Green's function, you can always write different conventions for the causality. You can take an advanced Green's function, or you can take a time-ordered Green's function, just the same way as you can use retarded versus advanced potentials in electrodynamics. It's strictly a matter of personal preference which you like to use. In practice, the world looks retarded, so to speak, so we tend to use retarded Green's functions. Sorry about that. I think I need a glass of wine. And except in this institute where it looks extremely reasonable to me. So it's a matter of personal the point is that whatever causality convention you pick, the retarded convention, the time-ordered convention, or the advanced convention, or some other that you pick, if you Fourier transform into K and omega space and take the imaginary part, all those things look the same. Okay, they only differ in their real part, at least on the omega positive part of this axis. Okay, so the point is, when you just do an inelastic scattering experiment, there's no information in that about causality. You have to add that in as a constraint. Okay, sort of like you have to add in diffraction that the electron density is real. And if you do that, it's enough, if you get good enough data, to get the phases and get the dynamics out. Okay, and there are some, so that's, it sounds easy, but it's not. took a long time to get it to work. I won't get too far into the details, but there are so the bottom line is phase problems are always soluble if you've got really good data, okay? So how good is good? Maybe you can find smart theorists who will be able to tell you, well, you can get a factor of 10 worse data and I can still get the image out. But there always is this constraint of really of good enough data, right? So, yeah. It works in 1D. Time, there's only one axis.
No, I mean, I know, but 1D, the way that it doesn't work in 1D, because phase problem you can consider actually the polynomial.
Yeah.
One-dimensional polynomial factor.
Yeah, I understand that.
It
turns out this is an extremely strong constraint. It's a much stronger constraint than just rho is real. Okay? It actually, there's a complete frequency dependence that comes out of this thing, if you've got good enough data. So it's a much stronger constraint than simply what you normally use in microscopy. So it works even in 1D. And so one of the things that make it challenging, one is the fact that you have to extrapolate for Kramer's Kronig, okay? So formally what that means is that chi describes the state of the system at some time t and how it is related to the state in all times in the past. For that relationship to be satisfied, the time interval has to be continuous. And it can only be continuous if the frequency interval is infinite. That's another way of saying that Kramer's Kronig needs, you know, extrapolation. So you need to go to very large frequencies. Fortunately, with X-rays, we can often do that. So you can scan over hundreds of EV or kilovolts if you need to. So here's a plot from, turns out, from graphite, where you can go above 100 EV and just extrapolation means normally appending zeros on the end. And I got to watch the clock here. The other issue, which is a little more subtle, is that it turns out that any discretely sampled set of data points violates causality. And this is what really made it hard to figure out how to do. So, and the reason that is so if I sample my experimental data on discrete frequency intervals, what that means is that the time axis is not infinite. Right? It means, in a sense, I have a Fourier series instead of a Fourier integral in the frequency direction. Okay, so if I just take my discrete set of points and I do an FFT, what I get is nonsense. And the reason is because so if you sample at frequencies delta spaced by delta omega, the dynamics necessarily repeat with a period 2 pi over delta omega, because that's just what happens when you have a finite sampling. And it turns out no periodic function can ever satisfy causality, right? Because causality means the function is zero at all negative times and non-zero only at positive times. A periodic function cannot satisfy that constraint. So you have to do some tricks, and this is really where the subtlety comes in. And the trick that we use that seems to work is we interpolate. Okay, we don't pretend that we have all the data, we just draw lines between the points. And what that does is it has the effect of making the omega axis continuous. Okay, then when you work out the Fourier transform analytically, and what you find that the response is zero at all negative times, so it's nice and causal, but nonetheless it's still periodic at positive times, in a sense sort of repeating itself, a bit like a pump probe experiment. In fact, there are some analogies with pump probe that are sort of deep that come out of this that I will talk about if I don't run out of time. Anyway, so if you extrapolate and interpolate, you get a chi that's causal and meaningful. So we wrote the first paper on this in 2004, showing electron dynamics in water. And this is what you get out, or movies like this. So this is the electron density in liquid water as a function of time, with a time resolution of 40 attoseconds. This is over a field of view of 10 by 10 angstrom. Later, we wrote a paper on the birth of the exciton in lithium fluoride. So this is the exciton in lithium fluoride, a 1D projection map of the density as a function of time. You can see the full scale here is 3 femtoseconds. We were able to show that this is actually a Frenkel exciton by analyzing the shape changes as a function of time and the internal structure of the exciton. And we just had a paper that came out on solvation dynamics in liquid water. This was with Gerard Wong's group, who unfortunately just moved to UCLA.
What's the other axis?
This axis?
Yes.
That's distance. So this is an exciton is a three-dimensional object, and this is a projection onto 1D of the density. And this is time. This is a 1D reconstruction. This was a 3D reconstruction because water is isotropic. And this was also 3D. And I'll show you a 2D in graphene in just a minute. Okay, so this is all happening independent of the literature on attoscience, which does not seem to be aware of our work. So our experiments are done in sector 9 at the advanced photon source. We use a standard inelastic scattering setup, which I won't get into. And it turns out it's impossible to do inelastic X-ray scattering on graphene. And the reason is because the number of electrons in one graphene sheet is very small. So our experiments are done on graphite. But it turns out, if you think a little bit, you can extract the response of graphene from measurements on graphite. And I'll show you in a minute how that works. So the data looks like this. So this is the energy on this axis. That's the intensity already normalized with the F-sum rule on the vertical axis. And these are just two different momentum transfers. And you can see what you get are two plasmons. So that one is around 6 eV. This one is at around 35. And these things are well known to exist from characteristic electron energy loss experiments done many years ago. And they have names. This is usually called the pi plasmon. And this is called the sigma pi plasmon. And these things turn out not to be plasmons in the sense that you normally think of. So plasmons you normally think of as electrons, free electrons screening, giving you some high energy collective mode from the long range Coulomb interaction. These two things do not come from free carrier screening. It turns out, if you look carefully, they actually come from Van Hove singularities in the band structure. This is a bit of a detail. But they're not plasmons in the normal sense of plasmons in a metal. They actually come from high energy excitations, and they're a bit more like the plasmons in an insulator. But if you look down here, you'll see a little shoulder on this curve, okay? And that turns out to be from the Dirac fermions. And I'll show you that in just a minute. The point I want to make here, though, is that the energy scale of all these excitations is high. Okay? In particular, they're much higher than T-perp. So what is T-perp? T-perp is the hybridization energy of the bands between the graphene sheets and graphite. So that means that as far as these excitations are concerned, there is no real distinction between graphene and between graphite and a bunch of graphene sheets that are coupled only by long-range Coulomb interaction rather than real bonding. Okay? So that actually will give you an algorithm to get the graphene response out. And I'll tell you a little more about that in a minute because I'm running out of time. So here's what the data looks like if you really do a complete measurement. So we actually did an entire symmetry independent sector of the Brillouin zone. So this is over hundreds of EV and up to 8 inverse angstrom. So if you go up to very large momentum, you can see what happens to the energy loss spectrum. So these are the two plasmons. Eventually turns into Compton scattering. And Compton scattering has been known in graphite for almost 100 years. Actually, Art Compton's first paper on Compton scattering was done on graphite. So that allows us to extrapolate this essentially to infinite energy and momentum, though it turns out not to be really necessary. And we did this at many different azimuthal angles in the basal plane because we thought the anisotropy may end up being important for the fine structure constant. It turns out it's not, but I'll show you what comes out anyway. Okay, so that was all measurements on graphite. So now the last step, take a deep breath, is how do you get the response for graphene from graphite? The way you do it is you have to make two assumptions, okay? The first assumption we are going to make is that the graphene sheets are very thin, okay? That's not such a crazy assumption. The other assumption we'll make is that the graphene sheets are only coupled by Coulomb interactions. That is that the hybridization between these atoms is small. They're just coupled by electrostatics. That's the reason that you can write with pencil lead, right? Because the graphite comes off in sheets. It's because the bonding between the layers is weak. It cleaves easily. They're just van der Waals bond. They're not actually covalently bonded much. Okay, so if you make these assumptions, then with a little bit of work, you can get the graphene response out. So now we have to come back to this issue that chi, if the system is inhomogeneous, depends on two momenta rather than one. So a graphene sheet is a rather homogeneous thing, but graphite is extremely inhomogeneous along the c-axis, right? The layers are very decoupled. So that means that this chi function is not just a function of one momentum, it's a function of two. And it turns out, because the system is periodic, they're related by a reciprocal lattice vector. They always have to sum up to some g. In the experiment, we don't actually measure all these g's. We only measure one of them. And the one we measure is for g equals 0. So in a sense, you could think of this thing as being a matrix, and we only measure the diagonal elements of that matrix. So the question is, how can I get the response of the whole thing, given that I only have this diagonal part? Okay. So that's all right. So that's the problem. So what do you do? So the thing to realize is that the chi function that we want is related to another function called the polarization function, pi. Okay. So chi is a sum of a whole bunch of electron hole bubbles. Pi is a sum of a bunch of bubbles, but they're bubbles that do not contain disconnected Coulomb lines. Okay, so pi, in a sense, is the propagator for charge, neglecting the long-range part of the Coulomb interaction. Okay, that's rigorously the way you can think about it. And to get chi from pi in a periodic system is a matrix sum, which looks like this. This is really tough at 5:20 on a Thursday, isn't it? So what do we do? So it turns out that if we make the assumption that the sheets are weakly coupled, what that means is that the pi function for graphite is the same as it is for graphene. Okay, so let me just go to the last hard slide, okay, and then I'll just show you that it works. So if you assume that the sheets are coupled only by Coulomb, what it means is that the chi for the 3D system for graphite is the same as the pi for the 2D system divided by D. So it's just a way of saying that the long range part of the Coulomb interaction doesn't influence any of the properties of the graphene sheet. It just influences if the sheets are only coupled by long-ranged Coulomb, because long-ranged Coulomb makes no contribution to pi, the pi functions will be the same in graphite and graphene. If you believe that graphite is just graphene sheets coupled by long-ranged Coulomb. Is that clear? You can read the paper when it comes out soon. So chi for graphene is pi over 1 minus v pi. If we also assume that the layers are very thin, what it means is that chi is independent of the z component of g, because if the layer is infinitely thin, then its Fourier components go all the way up to infinity. And that allows us to do this sum, which you can actually do analytically just on a piece of paper. And what you get is the relationship between chi and the pi function, which looks like this. And f is a form factor that describes essentially how Coulomb interactions work in a layered system. So what's the point of that? The point is that if this pi function is the same as that one, modulo a factor of d, that means that I can get a formula. So all I have to do is take this thing, solve for pi, plug it into that, and I get an expression for the propagator of graphene in terms of that for graphite. Okay? I don't actually even need to compute the pi function. I can just take this thing, plug it into here, and get that out. So when will this thing work? This will work on energy scales bigger than T perp, bigger than 0.4 eV. And in that range, the system is still Dirac-like. So you should still get information out that's relevant to the Dirac physics. And it will happen on momentum scales, let's say length scales longer than the thickness of a graphene sheet, which is much less than an angstrom. Well, yeah, substantially less than an angstrom, okay? So low Q, long wavelength, reasonably high energy, it works. So just to prove that it works, I have some more time. Let me just show you some. So there were some electron energy loss experiments done on suspended graphene and comparing them to graphite, okay? So these were done by a group in Daresbury. And what they found was that for graphite, the Eel spectrum looks very much like what we measure with inelastic X-ray scattering. For graphene, a single layer, these two plasmons are shifted to lower energy. And that turns out to be because in two dimensions, the Coulomb interaction is shorter ranged, so it makes these things shift down in energy because it doesn't harden the plasma frequency so much. So what we did is we took their graphite curve, pumped it through our algorithm to see and compared it to their graphene curve, okay? And to do that, this is what you get. So this is a scan here of their graphite data in blue. This red is their graphene data. The blue is their graphite data fed through our algorithm, and I've got here a slider bar that I can use to modify the k value. Okay, so I can use, in a sense, the momentum as a fit variable to make these two things fit. It turns out they didn't actually give the momentum. The reason this is necessary is they didn't give the momentum in the experiment. So we have to use it as a fit variable. All they did was say it's a small in-plane momentum. Anyway, the point is that when you turn down the k, this prefactor here starts to become big, and the plasmons start to shift. Okay, and you can see they shift the right way. When you start turning on the Coulomb interaction, they shift to lower frequency so you're turning off the 3D component and turning on the 2D component. They shift to lower frequency, which they should. And eventually, for a momentum transfer of about 0.3, the curves line right up. Okay, so the point being that this formula, which didn't explain the algebra very well, is based on reasonably well-posed approximations, and it works reasonably well. The point being that you can get the graphene response simply by doing experiments on graphite and using your head a little bit. So another approach would be to build a new accelerator, right? But this is cheaper, not to mention a little faster. Actually, the money wouldn't bother me, it's the time, right? Okay, so this is what you get. The fit variable we get is 0.3 inverse angstrom, which is similar to what they say in the paper. And the bottom line is, here's electron dynamics in graphene. So this is over a field of view of plus or minus 5 angstrom. The time resolution in this is 10.3 attoseconds. And that's what it looks like. So the thing that's interesting about this, the clock at the top is the running time. So the whole events are done by 300 attoseconds, and then it's over. So in 300 attoseconds, light travels 10 nanometers in vacuum, right? Pretty fast. So the thing that's interesting that you see come out of this is, in a sense, the second law of thermodynamics. Because what happens is the system you drive it out of equilibrium, right? But then as time goes on, the excitation, whatever it is, dissipates and eventually turns into heat. So when you take all the poles and you put them below the complex plane, and you assign a well-defined arrow of time to the problem, the second law of thermodynamics just falls out, right? Entropy always rises. It's the first time I saw it kind of gave me the creeps, but so there's something very deep just in the analytic properties of chi. We can talk about that tonight. So this is the same thing, but over a much, the scale is expanded in the vertical direction, and this is what it looks like. So if you zoom in a lot on the vertical scale, you can see there's a lot of experimental noise in here. The reason I show you that is you can see the six-fold symmetry didn't really come out so well in this one. You have to look carefully, but you can see a six-fold rotational symmetry, and that comes because this disturbance that you made backscatters off the atoms, which have a hexagonal symmetry to them. It's not that important for the fine structure constant. Okay, well, all right, when I give this talk at graphene conferences, no one's the slightest bit interested in the movies. The plot people like is this one. So just for completeness, this is a plot of our data compared to the theoretical polarization and chi functions for Dirac fermions in two dimensions, idealized, okay? So these are special spectra. They're taken at the lowest momentum transfers that we can measure, in particular at momenta for which h bar times the Fermi velocity times q is less than the energy of the Van Hove singularity. And in that regime, you can actually see the Dirac spectrum. What it looks like is actually a continuum below this pi plasmon. So these are two different momenta, and compared to them are the curves for Dirac fermions, which just come out of these two formulas, which you can see. So you can see what Dirac fermions look like is just a continuum. So they set in h bar times q times vf, and they go on up to infinity. In the real system, they look different. The two things that look different, first of all, are they have a smoother onset, although there's some noise in there. The other thing is that eventually you run into the top of the band, so this thing doesn't go forever. Eventually you see the fact that the pi band is finite, and then you get a peak out there that's related to that Van Hove singularity. So And the reason this is interesting actually is if you plot this pi function instead, so these are the theoretical curves for Dirac fermions, the data you can see, and the energy of the peak in the data is always about 0.6 eV lower than the peak energy that you expect based on idealized non-interacting Dirac fermions. And that actually comes from excitonic effects, which turned out to have been predicted by Steve Louis, who solved the beta-Salpeter equation and predicted a excitonic shift of 0.6 eV, which is exactly what we get. So this actually sort of experimentally is the first demonstration of excitonic effects in graphene. And it was a big deal when people found excitons in carbon nanotubes. And I hope that this will be viewed as the analogous experiment for graphene. Okay, so just to finish up, the thing that you really want is the fine structure constant. So to do that, we have to take a charge, put it in the graphene sheet, and see how it gets dressed. So that's done just by taking the chi function at zero frequency, multiplying by V, and Fourier transforming. So that's what it looks like. I just zoomed in the vertical scale so you can see the wiggles from the pi plasmon there. What's relevant for the fine structure constant is the total charge inside this object, because that will give you the renormalized charge of an electron and what it looks like. So on this plot is the function of Q of R. That's the integrated charge out to some cutoff radius R as a function of R. So the thing we want to know is at what value of Q does this thing plateau? Because that will give us the renormalized charge of an electron. So you can see it's zero, starts at zero, which is what it should do. Goes through a bunch of oscillations. So those you could call Friedel oscillations if you were a purist. And it plateaus to a value of 9/10 of an electron. So what that means is that if I put an electron in graphene, it gets screened nearly completely in the long wavelength limit. And that means the fine structure constant is actually a lot smaller than people believed because of all these screening processes from Dirac fermions and Van Hove singularities with excitonic effects and so on. If you plug it in and go through the algebra, the value you get for the fine structure constant is not 2. It's actually, we get 0.14 plus or minus 0.09, which is very close to 1/7, which I thought was kind of cute because, you know, in QED, it's 1/137, which is a prime. So this is also 1/1. So. Okay, and so let me just stop by saying that you can study attosecond dynamics if you solve the phase problem. The dynamics are real and causal. There are a lot of people out there who will tell you that what we do is nonsense. And the reason they tell you is that what they'll say, and I won't say who they are, is that we measure an autocorrelation function and not the real dynamics. So those people who talked to my program manager at DOE, who came to me and said, somebody told me that you can't measure dynamics, you just measure an autocorrelation function. I recommend you read one of the papers first and note that we actually solve the phase problem and we don't just measure an autocorrelator, we get the actual propagator. And the last thing I want to say is that we have a poster in the back of the room. My student Gan came all the way from Urbana and he has done a calculation showing that there is another more sophisticated way to do all this where you can really do crystallography on the excited states by doing standing wave techniques. And that may be, I think, a new way of doing crystallography. So, okay, I'll stop because the chairman is up. Thanks.
These are really nice results, Peter, and I certainly wouldn't take issue with the claim that you're measuring interesting dynamics. No, I guess I have a question for you, though, at least. In the time domain, or measuring things in the time domain becomes particularly relevant in systems that are inhomogeneous, where there's strong coupling.
Inhomogeneous in time.
Where there's sort of, where there's strong coupling, where the statistics are non-Markovian and so on. And I guess what comes to mind in your graphene measurement, and I don't know if this is an appropriate analogy, but this is my question to you.
Yeah.
You're assuming that the graphene sheets are identical, right? And you're
yes.
assuming, and you're assuming, or you've made a clear claim that there's weak coupling.
Yeah.
Could you extract chi if these sheets were not identical and they were coupled, and the sheets were, and their coupling between them were significant?
Okay.
And that's
so
sort
that,
of the analogy that
so
I would draw
a,
to
so
a
that's
homogeneous
a, you
system.
You could ask.
In
okay, that question could be posed identically to a crystallographer studying graphite and crystallography, right? So the point is, so there's a spatial aspect of this problem and there's a temporal aspect of this problem. And the spatial aspect lives under all the same constraints as other momentum type imaging. So you could just as well ask that to an electron microscopist. So the answer to that is yes, you can do that, though you need awesome data. Okay, and you have to use standing wave techniques, which are what our poster on the back of the room is about. On the time axis, the system is always homogeneous. And that is because the universe has time translational invariance. So the analogous inhomogeneity that you're thinking about is in space, not in time. So as long as the system has time translational invariance, the phase problem, as we've solved it, gives you the right dynamics. So whether the images are right is an imaging question. But so the only time that the spatial part of the problem is wrong is if there's some external time thing happening and you're not, and you're integrating over all that, and then you just sort of average over it. But in most cases, that's not the case, right?
Peter, this is great. The thing I don't understand is why you don't just use the energy loss spectroscopy directly. You can measure the imaginary part of one on epsilon from EELS data.
Yeah.
And you get exactly what you want for different, for as a function of omega and Q.
Well, that's what we did.
But you can do it from a single sheet. That we saw on the cover of Nature about
if you have electrons.
About a month ago, on the cover of Nature was an image of a single sheet of graphene taken in electron microscope.
Yes.
Now, those people record EELS, and this is a beautiful example because it's one of the very rare cases where absolutely no multiple elastic scattering.
Yep.
So you can interpret the thing quantitatively, get your epsilon of omega and K for different energy losses, and you have exactly what you want from one sheet.
Let me comment on that. Only in that there are two, there are a few practical issues. Well, first of all, Jim Zuo's down the hall from me, and you can guess we've talked about that. But the other issue is that electrons drill holes in graphene really fast, okay? And that's a practical issue. The other is that the energy scales of relevance are pretty low. And the best EEL spectrometers, well, they have energy resolutions of hundreds of milli EV. So, but yes, there's no reason you cannot apply this approach to EEL. In this case, it was 2/10 of an EV. So, but I've seen EEL spectrometers. There's one in Dresden. They show data with 80 milli EV resolution. You can do this with EELs. You can do it with neutrons. You can do it with ARPES data. It works on any momentum resolved technique that measures a correlation function.
So the dynamics that you're in a sense measuring is a very special one, right? I mean, in a sense, there is actually not any attosecond dynamics in the experiment here. It's more like, I mean, you're not doing an attosecond experiment in the sense that if you're exciting the system with an elastic scattering, and you're kind of placing an electron into the system, there's no way to know when that happens. And if you, in a sense, solve the time penetrating equation for this problem, you would find there is no attosecond dynamics. But
I'm confused. So what would you call this? The time resolution is...
This is not your measurement.
I'm sorry?
This is not... the dynamics here is not your measurement.
It's not a measurement in the same sense that if you do protein crystallography and show a protein structure, that's not the protein structure.
No, I mean, I have no problem with that. All I'm saying is that if one did, say, if one measured energies and if one measured states, so to speak, in the energy domain, and then one can, of course, form all sorts of wave packets and then just see how they evolve.
That's
so this is in the spirit, right? But it's also a very special kind of wave packet because it's the kind, as you said, the density Green's function would not, so to speak, be the most general type of wave packet or scenario one would consider.
It depends on who you talk to.
I know, but in this sense, right? So if I see it correctly, I mean, one could also imagine placing two electrons into the system and also looking at their interactions and seeing how that evolves.
That would be a higher order correlation function,
right.
Which we've already been talking about at this meeting.
We have two more questions.
Okay, just briefly, of course the dielectric response in graphene is anisotropic. And
in the AB plane, or out of plane.
Out of plane,
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly, you have no screening out of plane, so you have a much higher alpha there. I don't know if that's relevant at all.
It is, that's exactly what all this is about, The point is that a graphene sheet does not screen anything out of its own plane. So that means the Coulomb propagator is 2 pi e squared over q instead of 4 pi e squared over q squared. So you have to replace that in a rational way in order to get the dynamics of the graphene. And you can only do that because the layers are coupled by Coulomb. And that's what this whole rigmarole was about, right? Was doing that. It was taking out the 3D part and putting in the 2D propagator.
But doesn't that mean that alpha is anisotropic too?
You mean in
space?
In a single graphene sheet?
No, well, I mean, you can couple, you can have excitations out of the sheet too.
This thing, let's see.
You're just talking about in the sheet. That it's.
I'm talking, yeah, this does not apply. So once you do this transformation, everything is 2D. Everything lives in the sheet. And actually, all the things we measure are the longitudinal modes, which.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if it's relevant at all, but I mean.
So you're talking about some transverse mode of the graphene sheet. Let me not answer you yet.
Fine.
Let me think about that.
Okay, so I have, it may be a related question, but I'm going to phrase it slightly differently. So in particular, I'm interested not in the attosecond dynamics, Peter, but instead in the very long time dynamics. And in particular, what it seems like you've measured is the slope, you know, basically the Fermi velocity far from the Dirac point. And that the main difference between the graphene and the graphite is actually, you know, this real zero mass. And so the question is, well, one, am I thinking about this correctly?
Yeah.
And two, you know, what does that mean for, you know, having measured, you know, the effect of the properties of graphene itself?
And you're worried about long times, or you're worried about low
Well, you have
energy?
Finite energy resolution, so yeah, I'm worried about long
okay.
times.
Okay, well, all right. So everything, the entire scheme breaks down at energy scales less than T perp, because then you start feeling the fact that graphite doesn't really have a point, it's got a little pocket, and then actually it is a metal, and then everything changes. So down there, all this is wrong. So that would not be a regime where you ought to be comparing the data to your theory of graphene. Does that answer your question?
Maybe. So the bottom line is what you've done is you've just extrapolated the Fermi velocity from graphite to what you
right.
would have for graphene.
That's right. So I mean, the difference in graphene, you have this cone, it comes down to a point. Graphite also has a very nice cone, but it comes down and there's a little pocket. So the idea is to take the slope of this and use that as an extrapolation. And the graphene community by and large buys it. Alan McDonald believed me. So I'm an experimentalist, so that's what we did, right?
I don't want the possibility of interfering severely with the reception. So we will stop here and thank both speakers.